It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. In a few minutes, we'll hear about conflict within the Democratic Party over issues including the Affordable Care Act and the likely presidential candidates for 2016.
First, we kick off a WPR News series on education, focusing on Common Core curriculum.
Wisconsin lawmakers took hours of testimony on the Common Core state standards at public hearings last month held around the state. The committees got an earful, and the Republican chairs say they plan to issue a report soon with legislation that could possibly follow. In part one of our series on the controversial educational standards, Kristen Durst takes a look at what's at stake.
The West Bend School District in southeastern Wisconsin is just over 7,000 students, around 900 employees, and a mission.
Our mission statement is college and career readiness for all.
Ted Knightsky is the district's superintendent.
We want the kids in the West Bend School District to get a great education, go off and do great things, and then come back to their community and reinvest.
Knightsky supports the college and career readiness standards known as Common Core. He's one of many school superintendents and other public education leaders who've been speaking up for the embattled standards that are now firmly in place in Wisconsin's public schools. Tea Party Republicans and some Democrats want Wisconsin to drop Common Core. The state signed on to the standards along with 44 other states back in 2010. But it wasn't until more recently that the anti-Common Core movement gained steam. And Governor Scott Walker, who has previously supported the standards, made a comment a few months ago that seemed to put Common Core's future in the state in question.
I'd like to have Wisconsin have its own unique standards that I think can be higher than what's been established or what's been talked about at the national level.
Walker hasn't clarified whether that means he wants to abandon the standards entirely or just make changes. The task of what comes next is in the hands of legislators who recently held joint committee hearings around the state. Assembly Common Core Committee Chair Jeremy Thiesfeldt, who says he's skeptical of Common Core, says they'll review testimony and materials.
And we'll try to come to some sort of a conclusion that hopefully is going to satisfy everybody, although that's pretty tough.
For Republicans who may want to repeal Common Core, there are hurdles. At this point, public schools have already spent a lot of time and money implementing the standards. Republican State Senator Luther Olson, a supporter of Core, is the chair of the Senate's Education Committee.
I think that the horse is way out of this barn. In fact, I don't think you can see the horse anymore.
School districts have already had hours of professional development. They purchase new curriculum, new textbooks, and other materials all aligned to Common Core. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau's best estimate is that districts have spent around $25 million. Superintendent Knightsky says the financial stakes of this debate are high.
We would have flushed away hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm not going to say millions, but I mean lots of money spent on all of these things. A new standard means a new direction for a system. So we'd have to realign to whatever that is.
But ultimately, State Superintendent Tony Evers argues that the legislature doesn't have the authority to stop Common Core.
If indeed the legislature decides to take over this whole process and to essentially diminish my authority, or more importantly, diminish the local school district's authority, that'll end up in court.
Common Core Senate Committee Chair Republican Paul Farrow disagrees, and he says they're having legal counsel look into that claim.
I believe the Constitution, the way it's set, is superintendent, yes, is in charge of the education system, but they work at the purview of the rules set forth by the legislature.
The Assembly Special Committee on Common Core is slated to meet tomorrow, and Farrow and Thiesfeldt say they hope to have a joint report and recommendations on the Common Core state standards in the coming weeks. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. There's been a lot of news lately about conflict within the Republican Party between the mainstream establishment and the Tea Party movement. But lately, we've seen some conflict within the Democratic Party as well, especially with the troubled rollout of the Affordable Care Act.
Joining us now to talk about this is David Peterson, a professor of political science at Iowa State University. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
I want to start out with talking about some of those divisions. You know, we've, of course, been hearing about the divisions in the Republican Party for some time. And in the last week or so, we've been hearing about some of these divisions within the Democratic Party, particularly with the rollout of Obamacare, the House vote taken recently, and so forth. My question to you is, have those divisions been there all along, or are they the result of things that have been happening more recently?
I think to a certain extent those divisions have been there. I mean, one of the things that we've seen is that the Republican majority has been unable to exploit them, that the focus with the government shutdown and with the debt ceiling, you know, that those were agenda items outside the control to a certain extent of the Republican majority, and those were issues that divided the Republicans. The Obamacare rollout and the failure of healthcare.gov has enabled congressional leaders on the Republican side to push issues and to push votes that are going to divide the Democrats. That's the norm in Congress. The majority party usually uses its majority status to seek issues where they're unified and the opponents are divided. And you know, the surprise has been the Republicans just haven't been able to do that in the House recently.
So let's talk about the divisions a little bit. When you talk about the Republicans, of course, people talk about the Tea Party. They talk about moderate Republicans. If we're talking about the Democratic Party, how are those lines divided?
It's less clear how they're divided. In part, there doesn't seem to be an organized label for the divisions. I mean, we used to talk about blue dog Democrats, but most of them have been voted out of office now. And so it's a little less obvious. Really what it is it's members of Congress who are facing the Democratic members of Congress who are facing more risky electoral circumstances in 2014. You know, we know that a vote for Obamacare hurt Democrats in the 2010 election. And so what we're seeing some of the divisions now is that some of the Democrats are afraid that it might hurt them again in 2014.
And I read an article before I did this interview about some of those Democrats in these riskier areas, you know, seeing what's happening with healthcare.gov and the Obamacare rollout and all of that, are thinking about running for the hills right now. I think that was the phrase I read. And, you know, as you look at all of that, if they're running for the hill, are they running towards something or are they running away from something?
I think they're running away. I mean, they're running away from the implementation of the policy. To a certain extent, I think some of this is overblown because I don't think, you know, this is going to make a huge difference for incumbent members of Congress in 2014 right now. That, you know, in 12 months, I'm not sure a lot of voters are going to remember how they voted on some technical fix. You know, the votes that we're having now that are on some technical fix for a problem that or for a policy that clearly has some problems, but, you know, hopefully we'll get it figured out by, you know, the next 12 months.
And hopefully they will. But at this point, I think they're probably looking ahead to maybe a primary challenge, maybe something else happening, and wondering, you know, politics sometimes tends to be short-sighted. Maybe they're just not looking that far ahead.
Oh, sure. No, members of Congress, you know, when they're seeking re-election, they're always risk-averse, which I don't think everyone sort of takes for granted. You know, you got to remember these, you know, we look at members of Congress, we look at their incumbency re-election rates, and we say, well, you know, why are they so afraid of losing, right? They win 90, 95% of the time. But we got to remember that most of these members of Congress got there by beating somebody, or they've all observed their friends and colleagues losing, and they don't want to be that guy next time around. And so they do play it safe throughout their time in Congress and think hard about these risky votes. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind about at least these most recent vote is it's largely symbolic. I mean, it's not going anywhere in the Senate. Obama wouldn't sign it. And so it's not like the votes that the Democrats made, those Democrats who voted along with the Republican majority. It's not like their votes were consequential in any policy way, right? It didn't change the outcome of that roll call vote. And even if it did, it wouldn't have changed policy in any meaningful way because the Senate and the president would have blocked it. And so they're free to vote in the ways that are the most electorally safe because they know it isn't the consequential vote, like, say, passage of the Obamacare was originally, right? That was a vote that was really consequential, and so it was more difficult for Democrats to balance the actual policy implications of their vote along with the electoral implications of their vote. This one was free.
But even so, as the White House takes a look at what happened in the last week or so with that vote, what has to happen in terms of Obamacare that will bring some of those Democrats back into the fold? What is the White House looking at?
Well, I think, first off, they need to fix the stupid webpage. I mean, at some point, you know, if the policy works better, the Democrats will be more willing to stand behind it. You know, and this is a big, messy, complicated policy that has some strengths that people like, and it has some weaknesses that people don't like. And this is a moment where we're focusing on the things that we don't like. And in addition, we're finding a new thing we don't like, which is the implementation. And so, you know, if the implementation gets fixed and if we get past the initial shock of people not being able to keep their health insurance, but instead we get to, you know, people who previously hadn't had health insurance getting coverage, if we get people, you know, some of the people who are going to get subsidies or going to get expanded care or going to get lower costs for their coverage, if that becomes the narrative, Obamacare is a more popular thing and the Democrats are going to stand behind it. They need to shift the narrative back to the things that people like.
We're talking with David Peterson, a political scientist at Iowa State University, about some of the recent tensions and divisions within the Democratic Party.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think there will be or should be a progressive candidate in the Democratic primary mix? And who should it be? Will the troubled rollout of the Affordable Care Act hurt Democrats in elections next year? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue our conversation now about some of the rifts that are appearing within the Democratic Party at the national level and maybe even on the state level. If you'd like to join in the discussion, we've got room for you. You're welcome to call in with your opinion or your question for our guest. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guest this half hour is David Peterson. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State University. And David Peterson, no surprise, as we look at what's happening with President Obama's ratings, they are, they're not doing so well lately.
No, it's, we tend to see second-term presidents not do great, and it looks like Obama's approval has been mirroring the approval of George W. Bush during his second term.
And at the same time, he's got a lot in the line here, this signature piece of his, what could turn out to be his legacy as he's in the second term. He's got to be thinking about that. And as you see those numbers slip, does that give Democrats in the House or the Senate or anywhere else who might have stood by him more leeway to walk away, to run away, to distance themselves?
You know, I think members of Congress care most about what their specific constituents think. And the sort of national trends in presidential approval tell us something about what's the general trend within their districts. But members pay much closer attention to what their specific constituents think than approval. Approval, you know, helps presidents some, but it's, I think, generally overstated how much it actually influences or how much leverage it gives presidents with members of Congress.
So we could actually infer from that some of these Democrats who have voted for a different plan, you know, that the vote that was taken last week might be hearing from constituents on this, and their votes might be a reflection of that as opposed to some larger movement within the party.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, the presidential approval moves in tandem with the opinions of people across the country, right? It's a sort of aggregate of what we all think, and we tend to see similar movements within the districts. And so those members who are most fearful, those members who are most likely to face a strong challenge in 2014, particularly in the general election in 2014, are the ones who are the most responsive to these kinds of changes.
Now, as you look around the country, where are some of these districts that are going to be most kind of on the edge?
You know, a lot of them are the suburban districts. They're districts that have switched back and forth. They're districts that were close in 2012 between Obama and Romney. They're mixed. I mean, they're sort of all over.
800-642-1234 if you would like to join in the discussion. We're talking with David Peterson this half hour, professor of political science at Iowa State University, about the Democratic Party, what's happening with some Democrats in the wake of the Obamacare rollout. One of the questions I'd like to ask is kind of a hypothetical one. Let's say that the rollout of healthcare.gov went swimmingly. Let's say that everybody is happy with the way everything is working out, and we go back to that moment in the shutdown of the government and so forth. Would we even be having this discussion right now if that would have gone well?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the issue of, you know, people not being able to keep their insurance on whether or not Obama kept his promise on that would have been a relatively minor story, but it fit the broader narrative of the rollout issues. I think we'd still be focusing a lot more on the problems that the Republicans are facing than we would on what the Democrats are facing.
And the Republicans have to be happy about that, because all those issues that were there are still out there. They're just sort of being overshadowed right now by the Obamacare rollout.
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party is divided, and it has issues. I mean, it hasn't had a good couple of years. It lost the presidential election. It lost the battle of public opinion over the shutdown. And the one thing that seems to unify that party is opposition to Obama, not surprisingly, right? I mean, that's usually what unifies opposition parties. And so the more they can focus on Obamacare and the problems that the president is having, the more unified the party will be in Congress. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to, you know, go swimmingly for them going into 2014 once we start getting into primary season, let alone once we get to 2016.
Yeah, I want to move ahead a little bit and talk a little bit in general terms about 2016. As we look ahead to a presidential primary on the Democratic side, we've heard about Hillary Clinton. I heard something about Senator Elizabeth Warren as being a possibility. Who else might be emerging as we get closer to 2016?
I mean, it coming from, you know, living in Iowa,
yeah.
You got a front row seat to a lot of this. I'd be surprised if Biden doesn't try one last time. You know, he's been a good soldier for Obama. He worked really hard in Iowa. We saw him here a lot, and he connected well with folks while in 2012 while he was campaigning for Obama. And you know, this is his one last shot to run for president, and it'd be kind of hard to turn that down. We see Governor O'Malley of Maryland, his name float around. Governor Cuomo of New York. The one that everyone in Iowa mentions as the sort of dark horse, which I'd be a little surprised by, but gets mentioned, is Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, as a potential candidate as well. You know, at this point, it's early. I think it's pretty clear Hillary Clinton's most likely going to run, and if she does, I think it's pretty clear she's the front runner. But beyond that, it's pretty open.
It is early, as you say, but as you also say, you're in a state that weighs in early on these sorts of things. Do you have a sense of what's going to be important to Iowa in a Democratic primary? What are they going to be looking for in a candidate?
You know, at this point, I'm not quite sure. I think we have to see. It's going to depend upon how the rest of the Obama administration plays out. If the Obama administration is ending on a high note, right, if the economy rebounds, that's one thing. And then, you know, somebody can run. And I think both Biden and Clinton can sort of claim this mantle to a certain extent as Obama's successor, and they can run under that title. If the Obama administration doesn't turn things around, right, if approval is low, if the economy doesn't turn around, they're going to be looking for somebody not weighed down by Obama, right? They'll be looking for a new voice, you know, change we can believe in, well, something along those lines, in which case that'll hurt Biden. I think Hillary Clinton has enough of a political identity where she can sort of stand on her own and she can go either way. But in that case, that could open the door for somebody else a little more. You know, in Iowa, what really makes a difference is you know, face time with voters, of showing up and meeting people. Right, having a good organization, having resources, by which I don't really mean money, because money doesn't make a whole lot of difference, but having an organization and a staff that can get you to meet the right people, to be out talking to folks, showing up at the state fair, you know, doing those sort of retail politics things, that's what makes a real difference.
And that still matters in 2013, 2014, 2015.
Yeah. You know, it really does. We don't see, you know, we haven't seen as many Democrats coming through as we've seen Republicans coming through. You know, some of that is just the Republican establishment in the state has, you know, it still has the a lot of leftover from 2012, a lot of the lecture series or the fundraisers left over, and so they can sort of slip right in. The Democrats haven't ratcheted up their fundraising quite as much. But yeah, you know, people are laying the groundwork. They're coming to Iowa. They're talking to the movers and shakers in the state, and they're doing the things that they need to do.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That was David Peterson. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State University.
Coming up, a look at polyamory, that's multiple partner relationships, and why they're becoming more common and more public. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Next hour, we'll take a look at how America's food culture is becoming more experimental.
First, though, we're going to take a look at polyamorous relationships in the United States.
For many people, contemporary times have meant less adherence to a standard monogamous relationship with no premarital sex and one partner for a lifetime.
But today, things like premarital sex are common in mainstream culture, and many people engage in what is called serial monogamy, a series of relationships over a lifetime. Some also engage in polyamory, with multiple romantic relationships at one time.
Our next guest spent 15 years studying these relationships. She's Elizabeth Sheff, a global expert on polyamory and the author of The Polyamorists Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, why don't you define for us what polyamory is?
Polyamory is openly conducted, non-monogamous relationships that everyone who is affected by them ideally knows about them. So they're negotiated and people have talked about them before they jump into them.
And how is that different from polygamy?
Polygamy is generally practiced as polygyny, which is one man with multiple wives. Hardly ever is polygamy practiced as polyandry, or one woman with multiple husbands. Polyamory, a lot of polys there.
Yeah.
polyamory is different from both of those in a few ways. For one thing, those are forms of marriage, whereas polyamory, sometimes people are married and sometimes they're not. They can be together without any kind of formalized commitment. And secondly, and most importantly, polyamory is gender equitable in that both women and men can have multiple partner relationships. And generally, in the history of just cultures across time and all over the world, mostly polygamy has been men with multiple wives, but in very few places and very few times have women had multiple husbands. So polyamory is pretty rare that way.
So you've been studying this for 15 years, but I'm curious to find out how old are some of the oldest references to polyamory, and where might we find some of those references?
It depends on if you're looking specifically to the word polyamory or to more gender equitable non-monogamy. The Oneida community in New York was one of the first non-monogamous communes in the United States. John Humphrey Noyes was its founder. And that was, I'm going to make this date up. I'm going to say 1874, but I'm not sure about that. Sometime in those late 1800s.
I always, whenever I don't know a date, I always just go straight to late 1800s, and it almost always works out.
Uh-huh.
So does that mean it's a relatively recent phenomenon then?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
In terms of, you know, the arc of history, it sounds like a relatively recent phenomenon then.
Yes, absolutely. Not only in the arc of history, but the word itself, polyamory, was coined, I would say, in the mid to late 1980s. There's a little bit of disagreement over who exactly coined it. Most people think Morning Glory Ravenheart did, but it's possible that it was coined by, Jeff someone, I can't remember his name, in the Carista community. And if you'd like details, I actually have a pretty lengthy blog post on this on my website if you want to read the history of polyamory.
Yeah, we'll get that address from you towards the end of the interview, because I imagine a lot of people will want to check that out. So in the time that you've been studying these types of relationships, have you noticed a change within that time? I mean, is this a definition, a term that is continuing to evolve?
Yes, continuing to evolve in part because a lot of the people who do it don't necessarily agree with each other about precisely what it means. So there's some community disagreement over what exactly it is and who gets to decide. And also, I think the biggest change has been a much larger group of people practicing it. It's much more known, much more culturally recognizable. When I first started speaking about polyamory, hardly anyone in the audience had ever heard of it, hardly ever. And now pretty much at least a quarter of the audience members generally have already heard of it, often sometimes larger. So yes, far more people practicing it now, and it's looking like it's starting to become more diverse. It's been a very white, middle and upper middle class thing to do so far, and it's just becoming, I think, more diverse now.
And as it becomes more common, are there legal challenges to polyamory?
Absolutely. Up until this point, being taken to court for potential loss of custody of your children, if someone is contesting child custody involving a polyamorous family, almost universally people have lost their children in those cases. Just last year, though, the first case of which I'm aware went up before the judge, and the polyamorous family kept their child. So in addition to child custody, people can also be subject to things like you can get fired, job loss, and other kind of discriminatory acts that can lead to legal problems.
We are talking with Elizabeth Sheff. She's a global expert on polyamory and author of The Polyamorists Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts or questions about this topic, too. Do you have any experience with open or with polyamorous relationships? Do you have any questions about the polyamorous community? Do you wonder how widespread it is? Give us a call with a question or a comment for our guest. Our phone number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can also post comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time, and we're back with Elizabeth Sheff, global expert on polyamory and author of The Polyamorists Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts or questions on this topic. Do you have experience with these types of multiple partner relationships? Can you imagine them happening in your community? And do you have any questions about what that community might look like? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. Elizabeth Sheff, one of the questions I have for you before we get to calls is sort of a general one regarding how visible these relationships might be to the community where these families live. Is this something that people feel the need to sort of keep on the down low, or is this something that, depending on where they live, they might be very open outside of the family about it?
I would say both. If they live in Seattle or San Francisco or New York or Boston, any city with a large number of sexual minorities already, they're more likely to be open. In fact, Seattle has the first poly neighborhood that I'm aware of, because the houses are so large that they're great for multiple adults with kids. But I would say most often, poly families are not easily recognized. Like if you see a woman on the street with two men, the first thought that pops into your mind is not, oh, there's a woman with her two husbands. You're much more likely to think there's a woman with her husband and his brother or her brother or their friend. You know, lots of other explanations occur to you before woman with two husbands.
And in terms of being a sexual minority, do you have any idea as to what the numbers look like or a percentage might look like across the country? I mean, is this a big, big population or is it still just a subset?
I would say it's still pretty subset. I think that there are fewer polyamorists in general than swingers. And it's really hard to say how many polyamorists or sexual minorities there are in general. But I've looked at several different estimates that look at the number of bisexual people in reported polyamorous populations and then extrapolates from the number of bisexual people in the state. And those, depending on how that's calculated, they come up with between 2 million and like 9.3 million polyamorists in the United States. So even the most generous estimate is probably less than 10 million, which is pretty sub, but far more substantial than they were 10 years ago.
And that's quite a range in that estimate there.
Let's
take some phone calls. We have Sarah in Madison waiting to talk to us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have experience with polyamorous relationships in the Madison area. And I'm kind of just wondering how these relationships and the prevalence of these relationships tend to look throughout the lifespan. It tends to be very accepted in my peer group in the younger 20s and things like that. And I'm wondering if polyamorous families and things like that see the same level of acceptance in the normal city communities, especially in neighborhoods, raising families, and things like that.
Elizabeth, do you know?
Yes, that's a great question. I would say that non-monogamy in general is more accepted among younger people. And that there's definitely a segment of people who may call themselves poly for now, or may just be poly for now but not identify that way, who are basically trying out polyamory. They're checking it out while they're in their 20s or whatever, want to play the field, but they're not having children in a polyamorous relationship. They think it's good for kind of sowing their wild oats, but they don't necessarily want to use it as a family style. So an entire segment of people will leave polyamory when they have children. Ironically, and another entire segment will become polyamorous when they have children because they find someone they fall in love with, and it just kind of happens to them, and they co-parent.
Maybe a little bit of a technical question here, but as you talk about whether or not polyamory is acceptable among older populations, how easy is it then to know whether or not people are polyamorous versus simply not reporting it because they feel that they would not be accepted?
That's probably one of the main things that makes it so difficult to count the number of polyamorous people. Not only do people feel safe reporting it, would they be rejected by their families or face some other kind of stigma, but
to whom would they report it? Like, is anyone asking this question?
Well,
I'm actually trying to ask the question,
yeah.
But getting a question on a national research survey that would give a representative sample of the United States is really expensive. And so I'm trying to start a Kickstarter campaign to raise enough money to fund that question.
I see. I was wondering how difficult it might be for you to do this type of research.
Tremendously. Traditional funding sources have not been interested at all, unfortunately, in funding this research. And I have tried, my goodness, have I tried. But it's very hard to find research funding for sexual minorities in general, but especially because in my study I found that these families were rather resilient, meaning there's a psychological theory that talks about resilience as an element of communication and ability to flex with changes over time can contribute to family resilience. And that's where my data pointed. So that's what I talked about. I didn't see child abuse or alcoholism or, you know, all sorts of other things that there's more plentiful funding for these catastrophic or these, you know, really negative outcomes. So if those had been happening, maybe I could have gotten funding for that. But I was not about to manufacture that to get money.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Chad is with us from Green Bay. Hi, Chad.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's your question?
My question is almost drawn into a concern question. My sister is in the realm of polyamory. She'd been married, had a girlfriend. They broke up. She's now still dating the girlfriend and yet has a new boyfriend, has a 2-year-old daughter from the marriage. You know, I have a hard time talking to her about the situation in regard to my niece and how that's going to affect her developmentally or, you know, anywhere. So I'm kind of asking, in your research or anything, have you come across anything with regard to children in these relationships and growing up?
Chad, that's a good question. And if I could expand on that, how do children understand these polyamorous relationships that they might be involved with?
You know, that's a great question. And the answer is it really depends on how old the child is. The 2-year-old, it's pretty much not going to affect her. She's not going to be able to distinguish her mother's date from other people in the social environment. She's just not, you know, little kids are they see the world through how it relates to them. So their people in their lives won't necessarily be like mom's boyfriend, but might be the one who plays with Legos or something like that. You know, the kids aren't thinking, small children aren't thinking about dating. They don't even get it. Tweens, by the time kids are like 8 through 11, they're really starting to notice that their families are different. But it doesn't seem to be that difficult for them to manage that information with their own peers. They, back to how polyamorous families aren't that recognizable, their peers don't tend to ask about it. They assume the families are divorced. And then by the time they're teenagers, they're very aware of the family dynamic and how different the family is. Generally, parents who become polyamorous, they have already got children, they will take their dating very slow and not introduce their partners to their children until they know this is a pretty darn serious relationship. So much like people who get divorced and date don't bring everyone home and don't, you know, bring everyone to Thanksgiving or something, these polyamorous parents use a lot of time getting to know people and
keeping them at a distance from the children unless and until they're going to be integrated into the family.
What are some of the largest families that you encountered?
Let's see. Generally, families often, especially if they're living together, will often top out at four or five. A four-person relationship is called a quad, and five or more are called moresomes, and they are generally, the larger relationship gets, the more rare it is. So the most common form is the open couple, like a male-female couple who've been together for however long, but they're in a committed relationship, and then they date other people as well. The smallest is the most common.
Well, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us. He had a question on how do polyamorous deal with jealousy? Is that an issue in these relationships?
It's a major issue in these relationships, and generally they talk about it. Is how they deal with everything. Polyamorists are big on communication. So they will talk about why someone is feeling jealous, and they'll look at if there are logistical things they can do to ameliorate the jealousy. So, for instance, if somebody gets really jealous when their husband is out on a date with his girlfriend, if the wife is at home, you know, like folding laundry and eating macaroni and cheese, that's going to set her up to feel more jealous. Whereas if she's drinking wine with her friends, you know, someone has come over or she also goes out and sees a movie with a friend or something, then that can help her feel less jealous if she's not sitting at home stewing. So they look at practical things they can do, and they look at the emotions behind the jealousy. Is this coming from a place of insecurity? Then what to do to help feel more secure? Does that person need some reassurance? Often polyamorists will reassure each other. Does that person need to seek inner strength? You know, often it's a combination of multiple things.
We've only got about a minute or so left, but one of the questions, you mentioned communication. What else do these types of relationships need to make them work? The level of complexity just seems to be a lot more than a lot of us are used to.
Definitely. So they take a lot of care and tending, these relationships. Communication is a big one, and honesty. Honesty is crucial for the kind of trust it takes to be with multiple partners. There are so many sexually transmitted infections that you've got to trust if your partner says they're using condoms with other people that they're actually doing it. And if they prove to be dishonest about something, how can you trust that they're actually using condoms as well? So honesty is key in these relationships and being willing to put a lot of effort into them.
Well, thank you.
Having a relationship as a hobby almost.
Elizabeth Sheff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Sheff is a global expert on polyamory and author of The Polyamorists Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll be back with a look at how climate change is affecting the Great Lakes. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.